Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Mary B. Cranston, past chair and current member of the board of the Commonwealth Club, and your moderator for this evening's program. We are very fortunate to have with us tonight Ken Feinberg, the prominent alternative dispute mediator, who has been called the master of disasters, although I think that's very flip. He has actually done some very profound work for this country. And he has negotiated settlements and administered repayment funds for victims of disasters over many of the most prominent problems that we've had in our times. The New York Times writer Fred Andrews observed that Feinberg has made a career of handling hot potatoes and moving them from the politician's plate to his own. At moments of national disaster, he has embraced the trying task of applying mere money to sustain and comfort the survivors and to bind wounds of the afflicted. From the Agent Orange lawsuits stemming from the Vietnam War to more modern disasters, including managing the victim compensation funds for the September 11th disaster, the BP Deepwater Horizon spill, and the federal bailout assistance program called TARP, where he was dubbed the Pazar because his job was to set the compensation for the top 25 executives of the companies that received TARP funds. He's currently working out settlements in Aurora, Colorado for the victims of the mass shootings there. Penn State has hired him to settle the victim fund in the aftermath of the Jerry Sandusky case. And he does many pro bono projects, including the Virginia Tech Shooting Fund, and then setting up the Hokie Spirit Memorial Fund coming out of that disaster. He's here to discuss how he crafts the many unconventional responses to unique catastrophes and how he tailors the law to the challenges of each of these problems. And we're thrilled to welcome him to the Commonwealth Club today. I know you're going to love him, Kenneth Feinberg.
I want to thank the Commonwealth Club. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club. And I also want to thank Mary for that introduction. She avoided calling me a model public servant. I always worry when anybody says that I'm a model public servant. 2 years ago, I'm down in the Gulf of Mexico with the BP oil spill, and I meet 300 fishermen in Plaquemines Parish, in the rural of rural areas of Louisiana. And the president of the parish introduces me, and he says, "Mr. Feinberg's here to listen to your tales of woe. He is a model public servant." Some fisherman in the back row grabs the mic and says, "You bet he's a model public servant. You know what a model is? A small replica of the real thing." That set me back a little bit for that meeting. This is really a thrill for me to be sort of a rite of passage for me to be given the opportunity with this distinguished heritage of this club to be given an opportunity to join the list over the years of speakers here. It is a special moment for me. And when I was offered the opportunity, I jumped at the chance. Adding to my visit are friends that go back 50 years or more from New Hampshire, who are here this evening to join in the crowd. So this is a very, very special evening for me. Now, and a former student of mine, Georgetown, class of 2000, mass torts. You have done well despite the fact that I taught you. I mean, obviously you've succeeded. The topic, unconventional responses to unique catastrophes. Now, understand some basic principles about what I do. Every once in a while in American life, not often, but every once in a while there is a tragedy that so captivates the American people and galvanizes our policymakers, a judge, a governor, a legislature, the Congress, a president, that policymakers decide there has to be a better way to compensate victims. Yes, you can go to court. You can hire lawyers. You can litigate. You may eventually achieve a pot of gold in the courtroom. But policymakers occasionally say, this tragedy requires us to think out of the box. And let's see if we can design and administer an alternative way to compensate innocent victims. So, after the Vietnam veterans came home from Vietnam and all claimed injury due to Agent Orange exposure, the herbicide used in Vietnam, the judge in that case set up a very unique compensation program and asked me to design and administer that program, and we paid out about $250 million to 250,000 Vietnam veterans. They all didn't get a check, obviously. There were different programs for different types of injury. After 9/11, 13 days after 9/11, Congress passed a law, and the law simply said, anybody who lost a loved one on 9/11, the airplanes, the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, or anybody who was physically injured as a result of the terrorist attacks, could voluntarily waive their right to litigate. Don't go to court. Don't sue the airlines. Don't sue the World Trade Center. Don't sue Massport. Don't sue the Port Authority. Don't sue Boeing for not having a firm cockpit door. Instead, come in voluntarily to a no-fault administrative system funded entirely by the taxpayer. Waive your right to sue, and you will receive compensation. And we've asked Ken Feinberg, and he will design and administer the program. Over the next 33 months, we distributed about $7 billion of your money, all taxpayer money, to 5,300 people who either lost a loved one on 9/11 or suffered burns or broken bones as a result of the attacks. The average payment, tax-free, in that program, for a death claim, $2 million. For a physical injury claim, $400,000. Tax-free, waive your right to sue. 2 weeks after the BP attack, the BP explosion in the Gulf, with oil spewing into the Gulf, BP went in and met with President Obama, and they came out, and BP said, we will front $20 billion. We will pay all legitimate claims in the Gulf of Mexico or wherever arising out of the oil spill. We will pay it. Don't have to go to court. Waive your right to sue. We'll pay the claim. And we agree with the president. Ken Feinberg will design and administer that program. In 16 months, that program distributed $6.5 billion and 220,000 people and businesses agreed to take the money and not sue. That was a fascinating assignment, BP. I received in 16 months 1.2 million claims from 50 states. I didn't know the oil got to California. I received about 800 claims from California. 800. And claims from 35 foreign countries. Some guy broke his leg mailing a letter in Oslo, Norway. He filed a claim. Now, most of those people didn't get paid. But build it and they will come. We received over a million claims, and we paid out billions of dollars before the first trial in that case was ever even scheduled to begin. In Aurora, after the movie shootings, Dark Knight, the governor of Colorado called and said, would you come out? We have $5 million to distribute, unsolicited, private money from people who sent in checks, and we distributed that money. In Virginia Tech, a deranged gunman, student, killed 32 students and faculty. Then he took his own life. There was $7 million there. The president of Virginia Tech called, would you come down to Blacksburg, Virginia, and help us design and administer a program for, like that? We did that. Last week, I was up chatting preliminarily in Newtown, Connecticut, with families who lost babies in the first grade or kindergarten up there, families that lost loved ones, talking about how there might be a compensation program established in Newtown to deal with those deaths and injuries. A little while ago, the governor of Massachusetts and the mayor of Boston announced that they will create a special compensation fund for the victims of the Marathon shootings, explosion, and that fund will be established where voluntary contributions can be sent to that fund, and down the road, after the funds are deposited, I'm sure there will be some sort of fund created to distribute, compensation formula to distribute monies to victims of that horrible tragedy in Boston. Now, what conclusions do I draw from all of this? Well, there are conclusions that I draw from like 30,000 feet that sort of tell me a lot about America, its legal system, and how these programs work. And here are some of the conclusions I've drawn. Never underestimate the charitable impulse of the American people. It is astounding to me. Nowhere else on earth do you find in so many of these tragedies the American people simply write checks and send in money to help victims. It is part of our character. It is part of our heritage. It is a wonderful thing. And I see it periodically. You'll see it now in Boston, where money will flow, just flow from businesses without any conditions. Here's the money. Spend it wisely. Help these innocent victims. It's a wonderful thing. Second, never underestimate the emotion associated with designing and administering these programs. My law degree, I think probably a wash, a divinity degree, or a degree in psychiatry in dealing with innocent victims. Mr. Feinberg, why my wife? Why my husband? He was a great man. Why did he? There is no God that would allow something like this to happen at 9/11 or in Boston. The emotion that you confront in trying to help people understand, I cannot bring back your wife, your son, your daughter. All I can do, and it's pretty small solace, is give you a check, the American way, in the hope that at least as to financial instability caused by the tragedy, this money will help. But that's all I can do. I cannot bring back a loved one. And it gets very, very difficult. Third, beware of victim expectation. Beware of victim expectation. Mr. Feinberg, I can't fish in the Gulf because of that oil. Wasn't my fault. Wasn't my fault, but I can't fish. And because I can't fish, I lost $100,000. Pay me. Okay? What proof do you have that you lost $100,000? Proof? We do things with a handshake down here in the Gulf. Well, that may be, but I can't pay you on the basis of a handshake. Show me proof. Thanks a lot. Thanks for nothing. Or I had one guy. I lost $100,000. I couldn't fish. Okay, show me proof. What proof do you want? Well, do you have a tax return? No. Okay. I don't need a tax return. Do you have a checkbook, profit and loss statements? Do you have trip tickets that you went out fishing? And yep, here. Okay, that's good enough. Next week, I'm going to cut you a check from the fund for $100,000. Now, with that check, you're going to get a 1099. A 1099? I waive it. You can't waive a 1099. I'm required. I got to give you the 1099. You're going to send a 1099 with the check? Yep. Rip up the check. You mean to tell me you're going to rip up a $100,000 check because you don't want to get a 1099? Rip it up. Never sent him the check. Probably hadn't filed a tax return in 20 years. But the fact of the matter is there's an expectation when these programs are established that is, shall we say, very, very stressful in trying to deal with it. So that's another problem you've got. And then there is a major philosophic issue that I pose to this rather sophisticated audience. 9/11 is the best example. BP also, but 9/11 is the best example I know of. Is a program like 9/11 sound public policy? Is it a good idea? Now, I happen to think that the 9/11 Fund was a fabulous idea. I think it exhibited the best in our character, in our desire to help our fellow citizens, show our allegiance, our sense of community. I think when I look at 9/11, the 9/11 Fund, I believe it was a stunning success. Just don't ever do it again. Don't ever do it again. It's a very close call. You should have read some of the emails I got when I was administering that fund. Dear Mr. Feinberg, my son died in Oklahoma City. Where's my check? Dear Mr. Feinberg, I don't get it. My wife died in the basement of the World Trade Center in the original 1993 attacks. How come I'm not eligible for compensation? And it wasn't just terror, you see. Dear Mr. Feinberg, you got to explain something to me. Last year, my wife saved three little girls from drowning in the Mississippi River, and then she drowned a heroine. Where's my check? Bad things happen to good people every day in America. And there isn't $2 million tax-free of the taxpayers' money waiting there. Now, I think 9/11 is an exception. I think 9/11, in terms of its impact on our psyche as a people, is rivaled only by the American Civil War and Pearl Harbor and perhaps the assassination of President Kennedy. But other than that, you're hard pressed to justify in a society that believes in equal protection, frowns on elitism, endorses egalitarianism, having a special taxpayer-funded program only for you. Everybody else, fend for yourself. Very difficult. Now, in a way, it's moot because I don't see the 9/11 fund, which is now, what, 12 years old? There was no 9/11 fund for Katrina. There was over 1,000 people died. There was no 9/11 fund for a Hurricane Sandy or tornadoes or earthquakes or other tragedies. I think the 9/11 fund was a unique response to an unprecedented national tragedy. And I don't think you'll see it again. I don't think you'll see a BP oil spill fund again either. Now, maybe. It's possible, I suppose, that there could be another tragedy where a corporation steps up to the plate and says, don't go to court. Don't do anything. Don't hire a lawyer. We will immediately put up $20 billion to pay claims. I haven't seen any companies before or after put up $20 billion or anything like that. I got letters during the BP fund also. Dear Mr. Feinberg, I don't get it. I'm a victim of Exxon Valdez. I've been litigating for 22 years and I'm still litigating. Where's my check? I want to get in the BP fund. I don't care about Exxon Valdez. I want the BP fund. That's quicker. I want that. Sorry, you're not eligible. You didn't. Your damage wasn't caused by the BP oil spill. Now, notice in that case, BP said, we'll cut the checks and we'll pay the claims, and later on, we'll worry about insurance, we'll worry about co-defendants like Halliburton or Anadarko or Transocean. That's our problem. Feinberg, you just pay the victims. Shrimpers, oyster harvesters, hotels. And it was very, very difficult, BP, the sheer volume of claims. The problem with 9/11 wasn't the volume of claims. You either got out of those buildings or planes or you didn't. There were some physical injury claims, but not that many. The problem with 9/11 is Congress, in its wisdom, decided to set the program up weeks after 9/11. Well, Mrs. Jones, you lost your son, and I'm here to tell you that you're eligible to receive $3 million. You're here to talk to me about money? I lost my son. They haven't even found his body. Bring back my son. You can keep the $3 million. Problems like that are very difficult to deal with. Very, very difficult to deal with. Before I take questions, I'll give you a couple of examples of this. In these programs, when you try and deal one-on-one with individuals who have suffered such horrible loss, brace yourself for what you're going to hear. Brace yourself. But the secret to the 9/11 fund was our decision to give everybody who wanted it the right to be heard. Nobody came to talk to me about money. People came to talk to me to validate the memory of a lost loved one. That's why they came to see me. Or they came to see me with terrible stories. Mr. Feinberg, I'm 71 years old. I lost my son at the Pentagon. He got out of the building after the plane hit, but he thought that my daughter, his sister, was trapped. So he went back into the building to look for his sister. His sister had already got out a side door. He died looking for her. My life is over, Mr. Feinberg. I'm 71. My daughter is okay. I lost my son. A parent shouldn't bury a son. And then I made a terrible mistake. I made a terrible, well-intentioned, you learn from these assignments, believe me. I made a terrible blunder. I said to this man, Mr. Jones, this is such a tragedy. I know how you feel. This man, with tears in his eyes, looks to me and he says, Mr. Feinberg, you've got a very tough job. I don't envy what you're doing. But a word of advice. Don't tell anybody you know how they feel. You have no idea how I feel. And that will not sit well, Mr. Feinberg, with people. I never said that again. But that's the example, you see. So I think that although these programs that I've been involved in, although I think they work, I think they've done exactly, sometimes people accuse me of setting up these programs. I didn't set up the programs. Policymakers decide, let's do something different and ask Ken Feinberg to do it. Others make the decision to set up the program. Ma'am, you lost your son in Oklahoma City. Well, you're not eligible. That's the way they wrote the law. Tell it to Congress. Oh, that gets you real far. So I think sort of an irony that although these programs have worked as intended, they have achieved their objective, they raise profound philosophic questions about the wisdom of the public policy in singling out for just these people this type of compensation. And fortunately, I think, you don't see these programs that often. There we are. Now, according to Mary, who runs a tight ship, you know, a lawyer, I think you have some questions, and then the audience.
I do. Well, I've been getting questions from the audience, so what I'll be doing is grouping questions and asking them to you, and I really want to thank you for your initial comments. They're very moving. And let me just say, this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to attorney and dispute mediator Kenneth Feinberg about his career settling some of America's most challenging and emotional crises of our time. And I'm Mary Cranston, your moderator. So first question would be, coming out of September 11th, that followed your work on Agent Orange, where you were settling a tort case, essentially. And then the distribution fund for September 11 was a different kind of program, but the Congress told you you had to rely on some tort principles of causation of damage. And that troubled you, as I understand your book. Could you talk about, with all your years of experience, if you were the czar of how we would set up general compensation in this country for damage, what would you do? Would you use our tort system? Would you use some kind of fund such as the 9/11 fund?
I think the American legal system, with all of its flaws, works pretty well. I mean, does anyone have a better idea? These programs that I administer aren't a better idea. Be careful about policymakers delegating to just one person all of this authority. If it works, it's very efficient, it's quick, speedy, very generous. Yeah, but you're placing all of you're relying on one person. No right to the courts, no right to appeal. You don't have to take the money, but if you don't take the money, you're out of luck. No second guessing. I'm not sure that when you look at the alternatives, there is a better way than the American legal system. Frankly, even if you think that lawyers and trials take too long and it's not very efficient. One thing I've learned as a history major and in implementing these programs, the American legal system is so ingrained in the history of our country, it is part and parcel of our history, that even if you wanted to change it, I don't think you could. It's joined at the hip of everything over the last 200 years, more than 200 years. So I think it's here to stay. It can use some reform. What system can't use some fresh look and fresh insight? But wholesale changes in the way we dispense justice in this country by substituting something like what I do in 9/11, not a good idea.
You know, you've given a couple of examples of what you learned in these hearings that you had with the 9/11 victims. And we've got a number of questions about how to fundamentally value a life. And I just wondered if you could give some comments about how you felt coming out of those meetings with the families and how that influenced your decision to award compensation.
Well, first of all, this idea that I value lives like I'm a rabbi or a priest is a misunderstanding, really, of what I do. I did in 9/11 and in BP what judges and juries and courts do every day in every city, village, hamlet, town in our country. Judges and juries do it. In 9/11, it was delegated for me to do the same thing. If a lawyer gets hit by an automobile on Market Street and goes to, and the family goes to court, the judge and jury will decide. One, what would that lawyer have made over a lifetime, a work life, but for the accident? What's his or her economic loss? Money. What would that person have earned but for the tragedy? Two, add to that pain and suffering, emotional distress. Juries do that every day. What I did in 9/11 was just what judges and juries did, except I did it. People in this audience could do what I did. You could do what I did. It's not rocket science. Mr. Feinberg, I lost my wife. She was a banker. She was earning $1 million a year, and she was 38 years old. Okay. Bureau of the Census, labor statistics, your wife would have worked till she was 52 as a banker. And she would have got the following increases based on raw data. That's your economic loss. Pain and suffering, everybody gets the same pain and suffering. I'm not going to calibrate pain and suffering. Thank you. Everybody had the same pain and suffering. $250,000 for the death of your wife, $100,000 in addition for each surviving spouse and dependent. That's it. Add it up. With a calculator, add it up. That's it. Now, Congress, in its wisdom, did provide me some discretion. And I must say, unless you have a heart of stone when you meet families who lost loved ones, you're going to be impacted by what they say. And I may have added some additional money to those families that came to see me. Who wouldn't? I'm only human. The problem in 9/11 was not only how much money you pay people, but in 9/11 and BP, I learned another valuable lesson. Mr. Feinberg, I lost my brother on 9/11. And I'm filing a claim. Mr. Feinberg, I'm the sister of the brother. He hated the brother. Don't you give a dime to the brother, give it to me. Mr. Feinberg, I was the spouse. I was the fiancé of the victim. We were going to get married on September 12th. You should treat me like a spouse. Biological parents of the victim, what do you say to that? That marriage was never going to take place. Our son called us on September 10th and said, Mom, I'm calling it off. Fiancé, what do you say to that? Here's the wedding invitation, Mr. Feinberg. How dare them? Do you know that in August 11th, they held a shower for me and said, we're not losing the son, we're gaining a daughter. And now they say the marriage wasn't going to... Give me the money! Well, Congress bucked that one to me. See? You either work it out. I'll help you work it out. But if you can't work out who gets what, I'm taking the money and I'm depositing it in the local probate court and you can go fight it out down there. I am not a family counselor and I'm trying to get this money out and I'm not going to get into inter-family squabbles. I don't know the facts. So that's how we dealt with those problems.
You know, one of the things about the 9/11 fund was that 98% of the victims filed and chose not to sue. But there were, so I think you said there were seven families that did not file and they troubled you very much. Could you just talk about that briefly?
There were two families. You had a choice. Come into the 9/11 fund, But if you don't want, if you'd rather sue the airlines, you can do that. 97% came into the fund. 94 people decided to sue the airlines, and they all settled their cases later. Some may have got more, some got less, I don't know. Two families did nothing. They never entered the fund. They never filed a lawsuit. I went and met with one of those families, a lady of about 75 years old who lost her son at the World Trade Center. Mrs. Jones, this program expires in 2 weeks. I am here with the claim form. I will help you fill out the claim. You're going to get about $2 million, tax-free. Mr. Feinberg, go away. I lost my son, and you're here to talk to me about money? Leave the application on the kitchen table. I don't want to fill it out. Mrs. Jones, you don't understand. In 2 weeks, this program is over. If you haven't signed that claim form, you're out of luck. You're not going to be able to file a claim. Maybe you'll sue. I'm not going to sue. I don't want to do anything. I lost my son. Set up a foundation in your son's memory. Mr. Feinberg, please go away. She never did a thing. You learn a lot in these programs. Grief can paralyze people. Can paralyze people. I did everything I could to try and get her to file. She didn't. The other family, it wasn't a family, it was a priest who lost a brother. I'm not going to, I don't think it's right. Not right. Take the money, give it to Catholic Charities. Do something in your brother's name. Didn't do anything.
How has your personal view of how the world works changed as a consequence of working on these disasters?
Well, you say how's my personal view of how the world works? I'm very fatalistic. I mean, people go run in a marathon. I mean, really. Or they send their kids to school in a rural Virginia Tech. It's in the middle of nowhere. Blacksburg, Virginia. I mean, if you're sending your kid to somewhere where you think you're out of harm's way, you can't escape. You get very fatalistic when I see these Newtown. First graders? Dead? I mean, there's no rhyme or reason to it. And my attitude is that sooner or later, life will break your heart. I mean, that's just the way it is. And I read these things, and it just doesn't stand to reason. Half the people in 9/11 told me that as a result of 9/11, they no longer believe in God. The other half said, our faith is reaffirmed. One woman came to see me who lost her brother, said, I'm going to go to divinity school now. You find as many variations as there is in human nature when you do these programs.
Let's go and talk a little bit about the Gulf spill. I've got a number of questions wanting to know why, with $20 billion committed by BP, you only gave out six. And are there people who really feel they didn't get what they should have?
Why did I only give out six and a half when there's $20 billion committed? All right. A couple of answers to that. First, $6.5 billion basically paid all the legitimate claims. BP promised to pay up to $20 billion. We didn't need $20 billion to make 220,000 victims whole financially. That's point number one. Point number two, the $20 billion wasn't only for me to distribute. In addition to the $6.5 billion that I distributed, another $2 billion was used in cleanup costs in the Gulf out of the 20. That makes about $8.5 billion. There were government claims brought by government entities for other expenses, lost tax revenue, ad valorem real estate taxes, etc. Another billion, so we're up to $9.5 billion overhead to run the program with all these 34,000 claims adjusters and everything. Probably half the money was spent. Now, as soon as I was through, BP went and settled a lot of other claims that weren't eligible under my program using the remainder of the money. BP, I think, publicly has estimated that the overall cost of the Gulf cleanup will be about $35 billion for everything. And so my program, the president asked me to do, was a portion of that, not all of it.
If you step back and look at the entire BP catastrophe and the approach that you took, what would you say was the overall benefit, if any, to the public compared to a simple tort resolution? And what is BP's feeling about
it? Oh, BP thinks it was a home run. BP made a calculated decision for a lot of reasons. Business decision. We don't want to do Exxon Valdez. We want a better way. We want to get this behind us. We don't want to litigate for 20 years. We've got drilling permits sitting on the president's desk. We've got a stock price to worry about. We're a foreign company. We know all about the American legal system. We want to avoid that. We want out. We want out. I think that in that case, that this alternative program was absolutely a win-win for the American people, for the citizens of the Gulf. I mean, $6.5 billion out the door in 16 months. You're doing something right.
You know, for the really the first time in your career, you did take some political flack in the course of the BP.
For the first time.
Well, I would. That's probably a fair comment. I think what commentators have said is that the BP resolution brought a lot of additional political comment from opponents, and I just wondered how you felt about that and how did it affect you?
BP was a jihad of criticism. I mean, if you're an elected official in the Gulf of Mexico, pile on. Why not? You're not giving our constituents that. Why aren't you paying that guy just because he doesn't have any proof? Pay him. He's a constituent. He votes for me. Or, look, you're paying all of our fishermen and our shrimpers and our crabbers. Why aren't you paying the chiropractor? Why aren't you paying the dentist, the veterinarian? They all file claims. So I received a fair amount of criticism. Goes with the territory. I mean, you can't take it personal. You can't help but take it personal, I guess. But now also with BP, remember, whereas with 9/11 and Aurora and Virginia Tech and the Pazar, I did all of that pro bono. I mean, I didn't think you can get paid for those assignments, really. BP? Why shouldn't I get paid? An international oil company is putting up $20 billion, is basically saying we'll make everybody whole, including the guy administering the program. So in that case, BP paid the entire freight. Not only me, paid for everything. But, I mean, who else is going to pay? I was on Meet the Press. And David Gregory looks at me and you know, he says, Mr. Feinberg, you're doing this BP oil spill fund. This is terrific. Who's paying you? I go, BP. He goes, BP is paying you? I said to him, I said, on the air. I said, Mr. Gregory, do you have a better idea? No, I don't have any better idea. I mean, so what I did there is I went to Michael Mukasey, the former attorney general in the Bush administration, and I got him to review my pay, the package, and how it worked, and had him write a public letter saying, this pay is worth it, this is absolutely right, what he's doing is proper, and leave him alone. And I posted that letter. I mean, I showed it to everybody who wanted to see it, particularly certain Republican elected officials in the Gulf, and it went a long way in blunting the criticism. Plus, once you start paying out billions of dollars, the criticism sort of waned. After the program was over, I'll tell you an interesting story. I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, having lunch, and my cell phone rings. It says, blocked. I pick up the phone. Hello? Mr. Feinberg, would you hold for the president? Yes, I'll hold. I'll hold as long as you want me to hold.
Yeah.
Ken, I want to thank you. It was rough sledding at the beginning. You did the right thing. It worked on behalf of the American people. I want to thank you. I personally thank you. You took a lot of heat, but as the money started, I watched you on TV. As the money started going out the door, it blunted a lot of the criticism. And thank you very much. And he invited my family, myself. We went into the Oval Office. It was very, very exciting. It was very, very nice. It was very, very nice. And it's true. All the words in the world are no substitute for getting money out the door fast. That's the key to these programs. Get the money out to people and then walk away as fast as you can. Ducking while you walk away.
You know, one of the concerns you had about 9/11 was a certain percentage filed early, and then a lot of people were just holding back until the very end, and then everybody came in. So you made some changes for the VP situation. Why don't you talk about those? Because they were, I thought, ingenious.
2 points about that. You know what's amazing? You know how people wait till April 15th to file their tax returns at midnight? Okay. You can say people procrastinate. They don't want to give up their money. What you learn in these programs, when you have vulnerable, innocent victims, they wait till the last minute to get the money. In BP, Mary's right, in BP, I learned something about human nature. 2/3 of all the people who filed a claim in 9/11, 2/3 of all the people who filed a claim in 9/11 filed the last 5 months of the program. For the first 28 months, people held back. The devil you don't know. What is this all about? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. And then, the last 5 months, when we were announcing to everybody, there's not going to be an extension. The statute expires. This is it. Everybody came in. The last 5 months. The last couple of days, we stayed open till midnight in various 9/11 to accept applications. People were throwing them over the transom to get in under the wire. Postmarked the last day. In BP, we were worried about people filing and waiving their right to sue. So we announced a program. Anybody can come in and test the program with emergency compensation, no release. You can still sue if you want with the money. BP went crazy. You're giving away $100. How much money is it going to cost us to test? I said it'll cost about $2.5 billion. In 90 days, we gave out $2.5 billion to 180,000 people with no requirement that they do anything but take the money. Of those 180,000 people, I think 168,000 came back for a second check and signed the release. You learn a lot about how people in stress calculate when and whether to file these claims. It's very interesting.
I've gotten a number of questions about how large a staff you have to use and how you got this all orchestrated. How do you get it going?
All depends on the nature of the tragedy. In 9/11, PricewaterhouseCoopers, my favorite accountants, won the bid from the Department of Justice, and they received... We paid out $7 billion, and they received, under their contract, about $94 million. The cheapest federal program in American history. What, 2.8% overhead? Unbelievable. BP, With 1,200,000 claims, I hired about 4,000 people, 35 claims officers in the Gulf, claims adjusters, accountants, lawyers, translators, thousands of Vietnamese fishermen in the Gulf, and the deputy that has worked with me for over 30 years, Katie, you know, Camille Byros, did a fabulous job sort of overseeing that program. Aurora, you know, Virginia Tech, the governor had a staff, or the president of Virginia Tech, the university had a staff. It all depends on volume, really, and the assignment.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to attorney and dispute mediator Kenneth Feinberg about his career settling some of America's most challenging and emotional crises of our times. And I'm Mary Cranston, your moderator. I'd like to change our focus a little bit, talk about your days with Wall Street, when you were asked to become, as we said earlier, the czar of compensation and to set the salaries of the top 25 executives for AIG, B of A, Citigroup, Chrysler Financial, GM, and GMAC. What did you learn about executive compensation?
First of all, they call me the pay czar. Very unfortunate. My grandmother in Lithuania wouldn't know what to make of that title, I can tell you right now. She wouldn't get it at all. She'd be very confused. But I was really a mediator there, trying to work out. That was a statute Congress passed that says the government should fix the pay of executives who received all this taxpayer bailout money, Bank of America, Citigroup, AIG. Congress passed the law. Secretary of the Treasury Geithner asked me to do it, I did it. Now, here's what you learn about executive pay when you're paying people millions of dollars. The public thinks that it's all about material gain. I need this money because I'll have to give up private school for my kids, or I won't own a home on Long Island in the summer, or I won't have three cars in the driveway, right? The public thinks that the debate over how much to pay people is all about greed. Not so. I learned that's not the case. What I learned is that when you decide what you're going to pay somebody, these people on Wall Street, they're not from San Francisco. They're not from Main Street. And they look at compensation as validation of self-worth. And let me tell you something. When you get into a debate with somebody over what they feel they're entitled to when they look in the mirror in the morning, shaving or getting dressed, and you're going to drop their pay by 80% or 70%, they look at you and they say, you can't do this. I'm worth it. It is evidence of my success in the community. It is evidence of my success as a family person. It is the barometer of what I've achieved. And it's not about a beach house or another car. It's all about what I've achieved and what I'm worth as a human being. Now, you can agree or disagree with that, but it gets very emotional because people get their back up saying, who are you to tell me what I am worth, what my integrity validates in the way of pay? And that can become very, very difficult. Now, all of these executives, they all made the same arguments to me, all right? Here was one of the great ones. Mr. Feinberg, I'm the chief financial officer. If you don't pay me what I'm worth, I'm irreplaceable. First you say to him, the graveyards are filled with irreplaceable people, right? Right? Then... The chief financial officer says to me, if you don't pay me what I'm worth, I'm leaving this company. I'm leaving. And I'm going to go to a competitor. And you know where I'm going to go? China. Everybody's leaving the company to go to work in China. Everybody was going to China. None of them went to China, and none of them left the company. But you learn a lot about how to deal with these problems. I mean, it was an interesting assignment. Congress will never do that again either. That was populist revenge, right? If Congress is going to bail out these companies with taxpayer money, we'll get our revenge. We're creditors of these companies. Till they pay us back, we'll fix their pay. Government fixing private pay, not a good idea. Not. What do I know about Citibank's top 25 corporate officials? I know that the guy making $120 million a year is getting overpaid. That I knew. But beyond that, yeah, one guy was getting $110 million. But beyond that, anyway.
Well, how'd you do it?
Well, Congress laid out in the statute how to do it. First, Congress said, make sure that when you cut their pay, you don't cut it too much because we want them to remain competitive so they can repay the taxpayer, the loans. So Congress is like, on the one hand, slap them, but don't slap them too hard. It was a sideshow. So each of these companies come in with all their data. They hire McKinsey, you know, and Monitor Consulting and Pricewaterhouse, and they all come in. Here's what a CFO is worth in a company like ours, $7 million. Well, at Treasury, we do our own independent review of the data, and we say, no. You say $7 million, your CFO, we say $4 million. What do you say to that? Oh, it's apples and oranges. Our CFO is not like that CFO. It's $7 million because he drives the company car, he cooks in the cafeteria, he works in the library, he does all these other things. So $7 million is more appropriate than $4 million. Like that. You know. Eventually they all fall into line. The law confers on this one person this authority to do this. So we did it. And we did it right. We did exactly what Congress asked us to do. Congress was seen satisfied. But the president, the Secretary of the Treasury, we all made the same statement. This is not going to be expanded. This program isn't going to be broadened to other companies. It's only these seven. It is not going to continue. Once the company repays the taxpayer, they're out from under the thumb of Treasury. And, you know, Bank of America and Citigroup, when they read that if they repaid the taxpayer, they wouldn't have their pay fixed. They borrowed money to repay the taxpayer. And they immediately got out from under after, I think, two pay periods.
Now, one of the things is that the Congress did give you a clawback authority to take some of the salary back from these executives. You chose not to do that. Why was that?
Treasury Department. The Department of the Treasury shouldn't be a bill collector, I felt. If people received compensation legitimately, according to law, they didn't violate any regulations, Congress delegated the authority, if I wanted to file lawsuits or urge these companies to give back some of the money to people officials they had already paid. Let's move on. I mean, I wasn't going to. This whole thing was sort of a unique aberration. The idea that the Treasury Department should be fixing pay and that the Treasury Department might go after people who already spent the money they got. I didn't think that was an appropriate function, even though I had that authority. If I wanted to use it, I didn't use it.
You know, we've got a couple questions on the Agent Orange settlement, which was a very significant part of the healing of the Vietnam War. And could you talk a little bit about that process and what it taught you?
The Vietnam veterans sued the chemical industry, Dow, Monsanto, Hercules, and the Department of Defense, the Air Force, saying that while they served in Vietnam, the Air Force dropped Agent Orange, a defoliant, as an herbicide, to kill the vegetation so that the Viet Cong couldn't hide behind plants and trees and attack, ambush soldiers, but that the herbicide caused various horrible diseases, cancer and soft tissue sarcomas, liver disease. So they brought a lawsuit. The Department of Defense was dismissed on grounds of sovereign immunity. You can't sue the Department of Defense making decisions in wartime. That left the chemical industry. The chemical industry didn't want to fight the litigation before a Brooklyn jury in New York, so they settled the case. But now how do you distribute this money? The court said, I've looked at all the literature. No single Vietnam veteran can demonstrate in a court that his illness was caused by Agent Orange. Can't do it. There's no way, as a matter of law, that the science or the medicine justifies that link between exposure and injury. So the judge asked me to come up with a different way to compensate eligible Vietnam veterans. And what we decided is, let's not focus on medical causation. Let's simply say, simple, if you were exposed to Agent Orange in Vietnam and are now disabled, Social Security Administration, workers' comp, you've got a workers' comp disability finding. We'll pay the claim. If you're not disabled, if you don't have an official disability, we won't. And we ended up paying about 20,000 Vietnam veterans. Then we said we'll set aside about 50 million of the settlement and we'll set up a foundation to help fund programs to assist Vietnam veterans. And that turned out to be a very, very effective program. That's how we did it.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program where there's just time for one last question. And, you know, you've had such an amazing seat at the table for some of the real tragedies of our time, and you've dealt with people suffering through agonies. What has this taught you that you would want to tell your grandchildren about how to live their lives?
I grew up in Brockton, Massachusetts, when a fair-haired son of Massachusetts was president, President Kennedy. And I try and explain to my children and my grandchildren what it meant to be a teenager during those years when President Kennedy spoke about communitarianism, giving something back to your community, helping, that government is not a bad word. And I do these programs today that we've talked about today, and I must say, anytime somebody bashes government, it's very fashionable today to bash government. I think government service is an honorable thing to do. It is important. I believe in the communitarian ethic. I try and tell my kids, you can do whatever you do to make a life. It's all right. You can do whatever. But don't forget that you have some obligation, no matter what you do, to give back to the community. It can be a national, an international community. It can be a local community. Doesn't matter. But this notion that government and community service are bad words, I never believed it. I worked for many years for Senator Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, who taught me a great deal about government service. And what I try and explain, what I'd like to tell my grandchildren as they get a little bit older, is that the nature of the work I do, you don't have to do that same thing. Hopefully you won't have to do that same thing. But the communitarian ethic is something that's at bottom part of my sort of thinking, my philosophy. And that is, I think, a very, very important aspect at a time when it can be pretty lonely trying to defend these days, government and government service. And I think it can be defended and it should be promoted. And that's my view.
Thank you so much. And I'd like everyone to join me in thanking you. We want to thank you.
Thank you. Great.
Thank you for both your words of wisdom tonight and for everything you've done for this country. We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and also see a video of our programs online at Fora TV. I'm Mary Cranston, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.